Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Seeking Justice Show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next 90 minutes, I'll be co-hosting the show with my partner, Kim Colton. Kim, good evening.
Thank you, Denny. How are you tonight?
Well, I can't complain too much. And yourself?
Oh, pretty darn good.
Well,
well, tonight we are going to be seeking justice for Joan Webster. She is the 24-year-old Harvard University student who disappeared from Boston's Logan Airport on Saturday, November 28, 1981, after returning from a Thanksgiving visit to her parents in New Jersey. On April 18, 1990, Joan's remains were found in Hamilton, Massachusetts, 20 miles north of Boston. She was found under a pile of leaves and logs just 150 feet from a spot psychics led police to in 1982. The skull was broken, indicating she was probably killed by a blow to the head with a blunt instrument. A time and place of death could not be determined. Joining us to discuss this disturbing case will be Joan's sister-in-law, Eve Carson. Welcome, Eve, to the show.
Thank you, Kim and Denny, both. This is an extremely important case, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to really talk about it and make people aware of what all went on.
Well, we're so happy to have you here, and I know this has been your personal walk has been extraordinary as you've been dealing with this case and the amount of documentation that you have to support your evidence is just mind-boggling. So, Eve, could you take us back, please, to 1981 and tell us the story of your sister-in-law, Joan Webster, and the circumstances surrounding her murder?
Okay. Joan was a graduate student at Harvard. It was her second year in the School of Architectural Design. She was actually 25, and she had gone home for Thanksgiving break. She had worked extremely hard to get a project done, an 11-week project, which she presented the Monday before Thanksgiving. The reason she did press so hard was because she had been unable to go home the year before due to the workload, and she really wanted to take the time to enjoy her holiday, her family, her friends. And she went back early, which was really kind of surprising. She went back to school on Saturday night versus Sunday, or even riding with her sister, who lived in the Boston area as well. And so she flew back into Logan Airport on Saturday night, November 28, 1981. She was seen. She was confirmed to have been on that flight, and she was seen picking up her luggage at the luggage carousel. But basically after that, reports pretty much said that she vanished. She just plain disappeared.
Now, did she had talked to some fellow students once she got to Logan, correct?
She had spoken to a few people on the flight, and she had acknowledged a friend of hers at the luggage carousel. He was there with his girlfriend, and she waved to him and said she was taking a cab back to the dorm. That was her intent, and that was typically what she would have done.
Okay. Alrighty, and let's see. She was seen talking to someone, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's a report that came out in January that she actually had seen someone. And there was another article that I had never seen until I started digging into this case. There was a newspaper report in the Newark, New Jersey papers as well, that Joan actually had been seen. And so much so that a description was provided and a composite was drawn of it. Now, strangely, I never knew about a composite at that time, but none was ever broadcast. None was ever published in the paper. None was ever, put out on the airwaves in any way whatsoever. I know personally, I'd be screaming to have that out there. You know, who is this person?
Oh, yeah. So wasn't necessarily one of her student friends, one of her friends that saw her talking to this man.
No, no. This was a caddy identified her. This was a caddy that spoke with police and did give a description. And there was one brief mention of it in one news article, and then the other article that I found out of the New Jersey papers. And we have been able to confirm that. That indeed was the case. There is a composite. It's not something that I have released, and there are reasons why I don't, partly because this case got off on so many different tangents. It got so very confusing. And I don't want that to happen again. I believe we're looking in the right area now.
Did you ever see the composite sketch?
I didn't at the time, and I didn't until this last year through the digging and whatnot. I now have a copy of the composite. I haven't.
Who do you think it? Well, let's get into this a little bit more, and we have a whole cast of characters here to talk about, and then I do want you to give your opinion as who you think it looks like, if it looks like any of them.
Okay.
Okay. So Joan, she didn't show up for classes on Monday, November 30th.
That is correct.
And her parents had not heard from her, and take it from there. She was reported missing to security at the university. Correct.
She was reported missing actually in two different places. There are two initial reports. One was to the Harvard campus police, and the other one was done in New Jersey. We did not know for 3 days that Joan was missing. There had been no safe arrival call, and we didn't know. We had no idea. So, you know, her whereabouts were not registering with anybody until she did not show up for classes. And that is what's indicated in both of those initial reports. That's when people became alarmed.
Mm-hmm.
Those two initial reports, you know, they described what she was wearing when she was last seen. Her family, both parents and her sister, took her to the airport that evening. And her flight arrived around 10 o'clock on that Saturday night. Took about a half an hour to collect the luggage because there was all of the carousels were down except one, and there were about five flights that came in all roughly around the same time. So there was quite a crowd there. I mean, this was a busy airport on Saturday night following Thanksgiving. You know, interesting that not that many people noticed her, but obviously some did, and that is something that, you know, is something that I have focused on quite a bit because it did apparently become something, an evidence that became suppressed.
Okay. Now, I was wondering when we were going to talk about Marie Iannuzzi, and I'm wondering if now isn't kind of a good time to kind of bring that in just briefly. Marie Iannuzzi was a woman who was found murdered in 1979. So this was prior to Joan's disappearance and murder. But nonetheless, it's somewhat significant. Let's just, if you could, just take us through Marie's, what happened with her and her boyfriend, David Doyle, and just briefly, and then we'll get right back to Joan.
Okay, well, in order to preface that, if I can take a minute and try to describe what the climate was like at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Boston, and these were things I really have had to study and really had to understand, and I'm not sure that they were things that were readily apparent to anyone at the time. I mean, some of it certainly was. There was a lot of organized crime in Boston. There were two major factions. There was the Mafia, and there was the Irish mob. What wasn't necessarily known at the time was the corruption in the FBI office. The FBI office was extremely corrupt. And it was very deeply rooted. It had been for many years. There are cases where FBI agents knowingly and intentionally protected criminal informants, murderers, and wrongfully convicted people to cover up the, you know, take the blame for the crimes. Also at the same time, the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, which is the office at that time that handled Joan's case, and handled the other case that you just referenced, Marie Iannuzzi. They were found in 1991 to have been very corrupt. They were found to have had secret and duplicate files that were held within their office, holding back, you know, exculpatory evidence for defendants in cases that went from 1980 to 1988, when the homicide division was under the was being handled by a man by the name of John Kiernan. He was the lawyer in that office that took care of that and dealt with the homicide cases. So this certainly all fell in there. Mr. Paradiso's name was brought up.
Well, let's just, if we could, now, Marie was, tell us a little bit about Marie's murder. She was last seen, her boyfriend's name was David Doyle.
Her boyfriend's name was David Doyle.
And he was a, was he a CI? Is
what
that
what
he
they was,
call him?
He was, from the testimony that came out in that trial, he most definitely had all the appearances with a certain police officer of being an informant. They met on multiple occasions, undocumented meetings, and he certainly was in a hotbed and in a position where he would provide information to keep himself off the hook. He was a drug user,
so,
and he pushed.
So he was... But the relationship with this particular officer was more like that of an informant, but they definitely had, he met with this officer 20, 30 times and supplied information.
Absolutely.
Okay, and David had a girlfriend named Marie Iannuzzi, who they had a pretty volatile relationship.
They lived together. They lived together.
Okay.
And they did. They had an extremely volatile and abusive relationship, one that was known by, you know, her family and people surrounding them. They lived in an upstairs apartment of his parents' home in East Boston, and they had gone to a wedding. This was in August of 1979. The groom was a cousin of David Doyle's. And during the course of that afternoon, you know, during the reception that they had at a restaurant there, he had ripped his pants, and he had, David Doyle and Marie Iannuzzi got into a very heated argument that was witnessed by, you know, everyone who was there as a part of the wedding. And he decided not to go on to a house party later that night, and Marie went on without him. She proceeded to get extremely intoxicated and was asked by the family to leave the party, which she did not, and when they called her a cab. And finally, the father of the groom asked one of the guests if she would give Miss Iannuzzi a ride back to her home. The guest obliged, but Marie did not want to go home, so she was dropped off at a bar in East Boston, about two blocks from where she lived. The relationship of David Doyle, earlier that summer, there was an incident where she had gone over and spent some time at a girlfriend's house, staying with her, because David Doyle had been extremely aggressive with her, left strangulation and finger marks on her neck, and she was terrified. And sadly...
Yes.
We learned that, you know, you don't go back to a situation like that, but she did.
Now, the night she was dropped off at the bar, was that the last night she was seen alive?
She died that night. Or
she died
the
that
next,
night.
Or the next morning. She was she was murdered.
And what sort of circumstantial evidence was there that pointed to her boyfriend, David Doyle? Was there blood somewhere?
Yes, there was blood found on a step that led up to their apartment. He was seen having terrible gouge and scratch marks on his hands and also even one above his above and below one of his eyes. He had Marie's belongings all packed up prior to the body being identified, and he took off and left town the day of the funeral. He was arrested in Newark, New Jersey. He gave a false name, and the name he gave happened to be a stepbrother of Maria Iannuzzi's. It was one of her family members' names.
So it's not, it looks like he had some pretty strong circumstantial evidence against David Doyle.
Absolutely.
Now, let me just interject here and say that the police officer, this is a name I'm going to give our listeners now, the police officer who met 20, 30 times with David Doyle and supplied him with information, this officer's name was Trooper Andrew Palumbo.
That's correct.
And that is very significant later on in our story, stories, ladies and gentlemen, but I did just want to give a little background. Now, David Doyle was never charged with Marie's murder, and he was never even looked at. Isn't that correct?
Well, he was looked at. In that case, it was considered there were two suspects, and one of them was David Doyle, and the other one was a man by the name of Leonard Paradiso, who happened to also have been a guest at that wedding, and it was his girlfriend that had given Marie the ride to the bar, and they located some of her belongings in her car later that night, and Mr. Paradiso went and returned them to her at the bar. They were seen exiting the bar at the same time. What happened in the case was it really went cold, and Trooper Palumbo was not the initial officer that assigned as the lead investigator on the case. But later in time, February of 1981, he was. He became the lead investigator on that case, and he met with this man on numerous occasions without documenting anything, without recording anything, and certainly not in any way that you would interview someone that was a suspect in a murder case.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And David Doyle certainly was not charged with the murder.
No.
Now, let's go back to Joan's case. Let's leave that on the back burner for just a second. Now, Joan Webster, obviously, when she went missing, there was a great deal of, I can't imagine what was going on with the family at that time, the panic, trying to figure out where is she. And there was a reward set up for her. And if you can just kind of take us through a few of the pertinent things that happened during the time that she went missing and the times that her remains were found. And that was 1990. That was April 18th, 1990, a full 9 years after she disappeared.
Yeah.
So if you, go ahead.
Here's more or less how it cycled. She was reported missing 3 days after her flight, and that was on December the 1st, 1981. On December the 2nd, 1981, the very next day, Joan's purse and wallet were found. They were found by a man by the name of Anthony Belmonte in Saugus, Massachusetts, off the Lynn Marsh Road or Route 107. And a huge extensive search went on there. I mean, all kinds of things, scuba divers, you know, helicopters, dogs, even a backhoe digger. I mean, extensive search looking for more, but only her purse and wallet were found in that area. It was quite some time. It wasn't then until January that it was actually ITT. It was reported that the parents put up the reward, but it was ITT, George's employer, that put up the reward money of $10,000.
And George Webster is, of course,
her
George
father.
Webster
Joan's
is
father.
Joan's father. Okay.
That's correct. And so the $10,000 reward was put up. By this point, you know, there were daily articles in the paper. This became a very highly publicized case right off the bat. That reward came out, and shortly after that reward, there was a there were two anonymous calls placed. One was placed to the Saugus Police Department, and the other one was placed to George and Eleanor Webster, the parents. And that caller was later identified in court records. Her name was Patty Bono, and she claimed that Mr. Paradiso was guilty of both the Marie Iannuzzi murder and Joan. He was responsible for Joan's disappearance.
This came as a tip.
This came as a tip, as an anonymous tip.
But later it was found out to be Patty Bono.
That is correct. And Patty Bono was someone that knew Mr. Paradiso growing up and also knew one of the police officers involved growing up, a man by the name of Sergeant Carmen Tamaro, who was Trooper Palumbo's superior.
Right. Again, Trooper Andrew Palumbo from the 79 case we talked about is his superiors, Carmen Tamaro and Patty Bono. Carmen Tamaro and Paradiso were childhood friends.
That's correct.
Okay.
It was maybe a week after that that Joan's suitcase turned up, and her suitcase, and it was reported for years, and it was something that I always believed to be the case, was reported, found in the Greyhound bus station in Boston. And the reason I say it that way is because a book that was written that came out 2 years ago in 2008, written by the former prosecutor assigned to the case, Tim Burke, he goes into detail in his book and said the bag was actually recovered in New York. So that's still a very strong question that we've got as far as, you know, where exactly was this bag, and is his explanation for how it got there even accurate? I mean, certainly we're conditioned to believe our authorities and whatnot, but I have some very serious questions as to why was that bag in New York.
Oh, definitely.
And it wasn't a typo. I mean, he did go into detail about it. And all these years...
Could he have been wrong when it was really found at the Greyhound bus station? He just seems odd that it was found in New York, but...
Well, I mean, he's the prosecutor. He's had access to files that other people have not. And I would certainly think that he would be knowledgeable, or better be knowledgeable, about information such as that. There was one article I found in 1990, after her remains were found, that did also give the same explanation, and that her bag had been found in New York. So some questions are certainly there that need to be answered. It was shortly after that discovery that the Websters, George and Eleanor Webster, called a meeting, and it was a pretty high-powered meeting. They had three district attorney's offices, representatives from the Massachusetts State Police, the secretary of the Department of Safety, numerous police agencies, SAGAs, Harvard campus, Boston. I mean, this was a full house. And it was at that point that, you know, they discussed, I'm sure, strategy and any thoughts that they had on the case and kind of the unusual circumstances, because whether her bag was found in New York or Boston, either one, her items had been dispersed. Certainly, you know, was throwing things off and very confusing. It was very shortly after that. At that particular meeting, Tim Burke, an ADA out of the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, was assigned to the Joan Webster investigation, which there really wasn't a case at that time. That kind of confuses me, too. You know, they didn't have a case. They didn't know that a crime had been committed. It seemed like it, but they didn't know. And he was assigned that case along with Trooper Andrew Palumbo. He was also assigned the Marie Iannuzzi case. Now, there are questions as to whether a sister of Marie Iannuzzi called Tim Burke in Suffolk County for an Essex County case. They, you know, applied a very old rule that it was very close to a county line. But really, according to some other documents and some other things that people have recorded at the time that were in the newspaper and also in a book that covered Joan's case, you know, the case was handed to Mr. Burke by, you know, the district attorney, Newman Flanagan.
Okay.
And so it was literally right after that meeting, which was the end of February 1982, that a grand jury was started for the Marie Iannuzzi case, the 1979 murder. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Burke likes to claim that, you know, it was a John Doe grand jury to see which of the two suspects, David Doyle or Leonard Paradiso, who was it. And that's false. Mr. Burke is absolutely representing that in a false fashion. It began as the Commonwealth versus Leonard Paradiso, and it wasn't until later that it was changed to a John Doe grand jury. They went after Mr. Paradiso first. And the mm-hmm. thing that is very troubling to me is, you know, they had no new information in that case. The only thing that was different was Joan's disappearance and the fact that an anonymous tipster had implicated Mr. Paradiso in both crimes. That's all that was different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have a question in our chat room. It concerns her bag that was found in New York. Now, the bag, it wasn't found empty, correct?
That is correct. It had not been disturbed.
But the items that were found dispersed were more like her wallet, her purse.
Here's what
that
I mean
sort
by
of
dispersed.
Thing. Is that correct?
Here's what I mean by
and
dispersed.
And what was dispersed? Okay.
Her purse and wallet were found on the Lynn Marsh Road. Her suitcase was found, if it was found in Boston, if it had been placed in Boston, it was in an entirely different area. That was downtown, you know, and still not at the airport. She flew in. Her tote bag, she had a tote bag with her as well. That was never recovered. That was never found.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So by dispersed, I mean, I don't mean, you know, her items within those things were scattered. I mean that they were just in odd and different places. Nothing was left with the body. Nothing
mm-hmm.
was, you know,
that's
thrown
true.
Out in trash bins or whatnot. They were dispersed items, which was, I mean, the investigation in this case was all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
It was just everywhere.
So the prosecution is really going after Leonard Paradiso. And Leonard Paradiso was a 45-year-old former fish merchant. He, and this is for the Marie Iannuzzi case, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So he was basically how you feel that perhaps he was railroaded.
You know, it,
and they sent an innocent man to prison.
I believe that now. At the time, all of the information that I got made Mr. Paradiso look like he was responsible for Joan. I did not know very much about the Iannuzzi case at that time at all. George and Eleanor did go and sit through that trial, so they had more information certainly than I did, but I really had no knowledge of it at all. When I came to the point where I doubted that Mr. Paradiso had anything to do with Joan's murder was at the time that they located her body, which was in 1990, and where she was did not match up at all with the informant that they so heavily used for both cases. His statement was known to be false at that time because he said she had been dumped in the ocean.
And that was Robert Bond, correct?
That is Robert Bond. He was the informant that came up with a story for both cases.
And he alleges that Paradiso confessed.
That's correct.
But when everything came out in the wash, it didn't quite mesh anymore.
No, it didn't. I mean, her remains were found buried. His story was that Paradiso had claimed to have murdered my sister-in-law on his boat and then dumped her in the ocean and then ditched the boat a couple of days later. Well, the police officers had records in their files that the boat had been reported in July of 1981, months before Joan was on that flight. That, you know, whether someone would try and keep a boat, you know, make an insurance claim and then scam them and keep it. Well, the
right.
boat
because
was recovered.
Paradiso, Right, because Paradiso did report the boat missing in
July
of 81.
They had
and the insurance company verified it and paid a claim.
Yes, they did. And
but
he
yet,
was later acquitted of insurance fraud on the boat. He did sink his own boat. It was not stolen as he had reported it. But they had multiple witnesses that the boat had not been seen after that July time frame. And the boat was recovered. When it was recovered in September of 1983, it was found intact. It had the name on the back. It hadn't been painted. The registration numbers were on it. So, you know, if someone's going to pull off the perfect murder of Joan Webster, he was pretty stupid to have kept his boat right where he kept it. That's where
right.
it was. And
right. It was moored. In fact, it was brought up in September. It was found and brought up in September of 83, and it was found where it had been moored.
That's exactly right.
So,
and you know, they did had marine studies on the boat. They found that the boat had a broken rudder. The explanation they gave, suggesting that Mr. Paradiso could have taken Joan out into the harbor and dumped her in the ocean, they knew well before they ever went to trial with Maria Iannuzzi, and they knew at the time they were still promoting the boat theory that was impossible. The boat could not have gone out.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't have gone out, even if it was above the water.
And what kills me is that, of course, it's all a day late and a dollar short, because Paradiso began a life sentence in 1983.
No, not in 19. Well, he was arrested in 1982 and never released after that time. But he was convicted of the Iannuzzi murder actually in 1984.
And okay.
And really, you know, looking back and being able to look at actual evidence and actual documents now. The things that they represented as being Joan's were not. And the two things, there were only two things that really suggested Paradiso was responsible for Joan's murder. One of them was the Robert Bond statement, which is false. I've read it. It is false. And number two was the connection to the Marie Iannuzzi case. And I've now gone back and reviewed that case extensively, through the grand jury records, through pretrial testimony, through the trial testimony, motions, police reports. He did not commit that crime.
No.
Nothing pointed to him in that crime. You had such egregious misconduct going on. And let me explain a little bit how that happened. For example, Mr. Bond's statement made the claim that the night of Marie Iannuzzi's murder, that after the murder, Paradiso called his girlfriend and had her wake up her mother to talk to him on the telephone, I guess to establish an alibi. I guess that would be the thinking behind making that statement. Well, her parents were called into a grand jury, but they were called into a John Doe or Jane Doe grand jury for Joan. And therefore, Mr. Paradiso's defense attorney could not ask for discovery. He could not get those records to help him discredit Mr. Bond's statement. Another way that it happened was the FBI was involved in this case very early on. And remember, this was a corrupt FBI office. There were so many dirty things going on in that office that are still coming out in lawsuits today. They had multiple case numbers, and really kind of piling on. Things got buried in different parts of, under different numbers where they couldn't be located, and he couldn't access them. He was never charged with a crime in Joan's case, so he couldn't subpoena those records. For example, lab results off the boat. There was nothing found on that boat that ever connected Joan to it, ever.
Right, right. And he also, and Paradiso also passed a lie detector, a polygraph, too.
Yes, he passed a lie detector, and a private investigator that was involved with this case early on, who always has maintained Mr. Paradiso's innocence for both murders, knew that the individual that administered that lie detector test and said he was the best of the best. You know, if he was able to pass a lie detector test through that person, he had confidence in it.
Hmm.
And he took it at a time when he wasn't even charged with the Iannuzzi crime. I mean, he knew he would be looked at. You know, Mr. Paradiso was not a saint. He had issues. He had been in jail for an assault. He was a parolee, which was one reason that made him a suspect in the 1979 murder. And so he let his parole officer know. He did the right things. And no, he did not commit that crime. And therefore, removes everything that associates him in any way to Joan.
We have a couple of questions here in the chat room. One question is, did they look at the people on board her flight as suspects? Perhaps someone targeted her during the flight.
I know they questioned extensively. They had all sorts of people that first week that talked to people off of the flights, people that worked at the airport, cabbies, classmates. I mean, they interviewed hundreds of people. I do believe that's a really legitimate thing to be looking at. I know when her remains were found that the authorities that were involved in that, when the investigation tried to reopen in some sense in 1990, that they were convinced, based on the condition of her remains, where they were and whatnot, that it was probably someone that knew Joan. And I would say that everything I've seen and I've read and I've learned, this was a premeditated murder. So whether it was someone on her flight, I don't know, but there were 5 flights that came in. And 2 mm-hmm. of them came from Newark, which is where Joan flew out of. There were 2.
And it could have been someone that she knew from school that knew her itinerary and knew she was getting in to Logan at that time.
Yeah, that would be a very short list of who knew she was going back early. Very, very small list.
That's true. Okay, another thing that we have in the chat room here is that there's just a couple of things we need to clear up for folks.
Okay.
So we're going to try to do that. I don't know if it's so much a question, but yes, there were 2 murders. Oh, it just flipped up on me here. Wait, hang on.
Okay.
There were 2 murders, and a man was convicted of the first one, and he was a suspect in Joan's case, correct?
Here's the way it really looks to be. The 1979 murder had pretty much been swept under the rug. They weren't going to do much about it. This was an unemployed young woman, a drug user. They pretty much swept it under the rug. And Mr. Paradiso was a suspect in that case. He was a parolee. He had been seen with the victim, and they had attended the same wedding. In 1981, when Joan disappeared, you know, they didn't know who to look at. And it is my belief that Mr. Paradiso became convenient. And because there was nothing, and there was nothing that connected him to Joan Webster, that they used the 1979 murder as a vehicle to really nail this guy so that they could pin Joan's murder on her. I don't know if that helps clear it up.
Mm-hmm. And when Mr. Burke wrote his book called The Paradiso File, Tim Burke, he hints at that he thinks that Paradiso killed Joan, correct?
He, you know, and to give him the benefit of the doubt on this, my belief is at this point that he probably initially believed Paradiso was responsible and therefore maybe justified in his own mind doing the things that he did, the misconduct to convict Mr. Paradiso for the Iannuzzi murder, because his conduct and the things that are blatantly false in his book. And I've got the documents that were submitted to the court. They're false. They have false statements in them. The search warrants that they executed under the guise of the Marie Iannuzzi murder, the only thing they walked out of there with were things that they tried to attach to Jones' case. Nothing to do with Marie Iannuzzi's case. This was strictly a vehicle to nail and provide a scapegoat for Jones' murder. Somebody had an agenda there.
Mm-hmm. They wanted to close the case. They wanted to say, okay, we know who did it, and don't worry, there's not a killer running among us.
Yeah. And at the same time, they're leaving two out there. You know, mm-hmm. one who murdered Marie Iannuzzi and one who murdered Joan.
Mm-hmm. I do want to give our call-in number at this time. If you have any comments or if you have any questions, please feel free to call in. The number is 646-478-0982. So, Denny, are you still with us there, buddy?
I am. I've been like a sponge here absorbing all this stuff.
It's a complex case. It is a very complex case.
Let me, if I could, Eve, ask you a couple of questions. I'd like to focus for a few minutes, if I could, on your investigation,
okay?
For a couple of reasons. First, to help everyone understand exactly how we got to where we are today. How you got there.
Okay.
And we have some of our listeners who will be listening live and will listen to the show on archive, who are going through a similar situation to yours, where they have a relative or a loved one or a close friend who has been murdered, and they're not satisfied with the status of the investigation or how the investigation by the police was handled, and maybe they can learn from you about some of the things you've done to try to find out the answers for yourself. So,
okay.
When did you really get, maybe I want to use the description, full tilt, into investigating Joan's case? When did you decide that you really wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to her?
In 2006, I started to make a couple of inquiries and really got shut down and closed out by the district attorney's office out there, who is custodian of the files, basically saying it's an open case, sorry. Later in that year, later in 2006, I learned that Mr. Burke was writing a book about the case, and I got very upset by that. Number one, because the theory in the case had been turned down. He did not gain an indictment from the grand jury in 1983, and again in 1985, he really pressed to find something to, you know, pin and attach Mr. Paradiso to Joan, and again, he did not succeed. I mean, this is not a plausible theory. At that point, because I was getting such resistance and getting resistance from authorities and knew this book was coming out, the next thing I tried to do was speak to a lawyer to see if I could suppress the book. I couldn't do that. Freedom of speech. So I hired a lawyer and an investigator to help me go through and get freedom of information requests out. We've interviewed some people that are close to the case in different aspects, and all of a sudden certain things started to fall into place. We have accumulated an enormous amount, about thousands of pages of documents, official documents, newspaper articles, interviews that are very relevant because they involve key people. And the pieces, I mean, it got uglier and uglier the deeper I got into this, realizing that the real obstruction to getting to the truth in this case are the authorities. And the problem there is where does a regular person such as myself go? I mean, I'm sitting with a powder keg of information that is relevant in an open murder case. And I'm getting blocked, frankly, getting blocked trying to bring it forward. And now I'm doing everything I can to speak out. I've used the internet heavily. I've learned to use it pretty well, you know, to try and find information and find people. And a lot of people, in doing that, in putting myself out there, I've also had a lot of people contact me who have been able to provide some very good information. I am on discussion boards. I've done some videos. I'm building a website that's in progress. It's constantly being updated because I'm adding and trying to make things available and trying to help it be clear. I've worked with a group of people on another website that we have that isn't that easy to follow, but we've been brainstorming and putting up documents and accumulating information jointly together to try and understand just what happened here, you know, and why are the very people that should be helping find the truth the ones who are really blocking it?
Let me ask you, so I understand, as far as the family goes, you are kind of the lone voice out there. In other words, you're working independently with your investigator, your attorney, and so forth, but you are footing the bills and so forth for any effort?
I am footing the bills, and the family wants to take the position perhaps that, they have believed this. I'm not sure what all they have seen. I know that I have documents now that they have not seen. And perhaps, you know, the parents are old enough now that, you know, they don't want to rehash it. I don't know. I don't want to speak for them.
Okay.
I know that the truth is important for me, and it's important for my children, Joan's nieces. They never had the opportunity to know her. She was an incredible young woman, and I want them to know her, and the truth is important. I look at myself more like a John Walsh. I'm not going to just be satisfied with to find out that things weren't truthful in that investigation and things were not truthful in, you know, just serving up a scapegoat on a silver platter to explain away the case or to close it. That's not okay. That has put me in a position where I'm really reliving this case again, and it hurts probably more the second time around than the first time, if that's even possible, because the people we trusted weren't truthful.
You say that murders, of course, child murders are never closed as closed. They become cold and so forth, but what is your impression of the status of the investigation into Joan's death now? It's not closed, but is it inactive? Do you think there are some leads that are being pursued? Is anything going on from the official investigative end of this?
When Freedom of Information requests were made, things got pretty heated out there, and all of a sudden, Joan Webster's case became classified as recently reopened. It's therefore being able to kind of hide behind and use that law to their advantage to keep people from accessing those files and for an independent investigation. Someone else, fresh eyes with fresh knowledge, able to take a look and go, you know, this wasn't right. And that's why I'm so very concerned about what's going on out there. The office that currently is custodian of those files, Essex County District Attorney's Office in Massachusetts, they have come out publicly and said that they are using Mr. Burke's book as a basis to open up other cold cases. Now, they refuse to answer whether Joan's was one of them, although I have that on an official document that Joan's case was reopened. But they're using it for other cold cases that are more similar to what happened in, they had young women who were from, the red light district of Boston, cases that were never explained. And, seeing if they can't tag those murders on Mr. Paradiso, they label him now as a serial killer. And I don't think the man murdered anybody.
Your efforts now, you have new information and so on. Could you tell us what you've done to try to get that out? I mean, when you've contacted, if you have contacted the police agency or agencies and said, hey, I've got this new information about Joan's murder, will someone take a look? Have they just told you, no, we're not interested, or we already know about it? Or how have you been handled in that regard when you've tried to bring certain facts to their attention?
It's been interesting. The first one contact I made, and that was actually before the book came out in 2007, I called the district attorney's office out there, and I spoke with a trooper, Brian O'Neill, spoke to him anonymously, didn't tell him who I was, didn't tell him what case this was about, and I told him the nature of some information that I did have. He said it would be extremely relevant. I was encouraged to bring it forward. He suggested that it might be related to a murder case in New Hampshire, which was not the case. When I did finally get the courage to come forward with information and let them know what case it was, they would hang the phone up on me. They would not return phone calls. They would not return faxes. They would not. I've also appealed to the Attorney General's office, Martha Coakley, and was flatly refused. I appealed to the Secretary of the Department of Safety, which happens to be the former Essex County District Attorney at the time of these cases. So he was the gentleman that did not indict David Doyle for Maria Iannuzzi's murder, and basically get no response. I know that my investigator got a very heated call from one of the assistant district attorneys in Essex County during the course of trying to gain information, and was demanding to know who his client was, and they're very hostile. And as a matter of fact, I have gotten feedback of some pretty nasty smearing.
And where do you foresee this going out? It seems like you've attempted to interest the parties that should be interested, and obviously you've not gotten a great response or a positive response. Do you think you have other options?
I do. Okay. I do have other options. I do have other options that are being explored. Right now, my main focus is to bring this attention to the attention of, you know, the public. People need to be aware of circumstances where there are wrongful convictions and where, you know, the victims become victimized all over again, and the tally number for victims just continues to escalate because you're not really looking for the truth, and you're not really looking for justice. That did not happen in Joan's case at all. Yes, I am. It is something that people need to be aware of. I mean, there have been two cases recently that have surfaced. One is the Amy Bishop case, which was from 1986 shooting in Massachusetts, which got swept
and just
under
to,
the rug.
Just to remind our listeners, Amy Bishop is the professor who gunned down recently, this, I don't know, a month ago or so, gunned down three of her associates. I just wanted to say that.
Right, the three professors in Atlanta, or in Georgia.
In Atlanta, right.
And she shot her brother when many years ago in Massachusetts. It was swept under the rug. Another case that came to the surface recently, and that was during the Senate race out there, was the Fells Acres case, where three innocent people were put in jail for many years on child abuse charges that were false and with false testimony. Massachusetts has got a whole string of these, and you know, these cases all took place at the same time that Joan's and Maria Iannuzzi's cases were taking place. And there is documented evidence that there was corruption both in the FBI and in, you know, on the state level. They have to be looked at, you know, when there's this much question. For me, it's a matter of being very outspoken and coming forward publicly. I'm doing everything I can to, you know, try and bring awareness to the case. But I'm also pursuing some other avenues as well still, you know, I still have belief in the system. I, you know, there were good officers that were involved in Jones' investigation. You know, this hurts them as much as it does, you know, the other victims. You know, they were out there in earnest trying to find my sister-in-law. And the way she was found should have been screaming to everybody that this case has to be looked at again, and that should have happened in 1990. And once again, pretty much got swept under the rug. Let me just...
I was just going to say, let's... well, you go ahead with finish what you were going to just say there, but I did want to say, let's get to how she was found and where.
Okay. That's what I was going to say.
Okay.
Yeah. We're on the same wavelength. Joan was... A vet was walking her dog in a... This is a very, very densely wooded area, very remote. I've been there. It is very remote. Extremely hard to find, and certainly anybody who was disposed of there, it's a miracle she was ever found. This woman was walking her dog, and part of the skull had surfaced. So that was the initial thing, and they authorities out there put together a group, a large group, that scoured the area for about a week. They were just about ready to give up. Three officers were out there just kind of looking the area over. They had found a little bit. They had found a few bones. They had found some miscellaneous clothing items, which, by the way, turned out not to be Jones. They were about ready to give up. The area is really a pretty difficult area to search. One of the officers knelt down, reached into a part of a decomposed log, and came out with a vertebrae. And at that point, they had found her gravesite, and they did recover almost the entire skeleton. She was found. She was found. Her skeleton had been completely stripped, so there were no traces of any clothing whatsoever. Nothing, you know, decomposition wouldn't account for that. There were no buttons, no nylons, no nothing. She had a ring on her finger. It was still there. And she had a gold chain around her neck. That was still with the skeleton. All of her clothing had been removed. She was found with a hole in the side of her head that was 2 inches by 4 inches. It took out the entire right side, which that defies the laws of physics the way Mr. Burke tries to explain the murder. He said she was hit in the head with a whiskey bottle in a crammed little boat area on a very bad weather night. And at the same time, he also tries to say that Mr. Paradiso is holding Joan by his other hand. You could not get that kind of leverage to inflict that kind of blow. The third factor, as far as how she was found, she was in, I suspect that it had started to rip or come apart, but she was found with a black plastic trash bag. It took me 2 days before I could get out of bed, realizing that there is no way that Mr. Burke's explanation for what happened could have ever taken place.
Can I interrupt you just one second? I was thinking about something that we talked about earlier regarding the evidence or Joan's possessions being dispersed, I think was the term. And going to the suitcase, my recollection of what you said is that there was one story that was found at the Greyhound station in Boston, then another story that was found somewhere in New York.
Correct.
Am I correct on that?
Yes, you are.
Okay, and the New York thing came from Burke's book?
It came from Burke's book. That's when I first discovered it. In going back through news articles, I did find one news article after Joan's remains had been found that said the bag had been recovered in New York, and it gave the same explanation. It said it had been transferred there when it hadn't been claimed in Boston. Now, I don't know whether that's how it got there or not, but the explanation that makes sense to me as far as why did that information come out then was the fact that you had new investigators now looking at this case and perhaps answering questions by the press It's the initial investigative group that I've got the biggest concerns about in this case and why this case was thrown off. I don't know exactly where that bag was found, but we need to know.
Well, you know, I'm wondering now, that bag was evidence. At some point, wouldn't they have to have had a chain of custody receipt or some documentation or paperwork?
They would have that, but they would have that in murder files that we've still not been able to access yet.
And they're citing the fact that the case is reopened and so forth, so it's confidentiality?
That's right.
Okay, did your lawyer perchance tell you, could this go on indefinitely? Could they kind of keep evidence confidential forever until the case is solved?
As long as they classify it as open, yes, they can. That's the law in Massachusetts that, they can deny it on grounds that it's an ongoing case. And kind of ironically, one of the comments was that they didn't want to hinder, they didn't want to intimidate anyone from coming forward as a witness. I'm sure I could run circles around any of the DAs and officers in that office as far as these cases, because I know them. I doubt they're doing anything with it.
If you had to sum up why you think that Jones' case is being handled, or perhaps not handled, in the manner that you've encountered, is there something specific about it, about her case, or is it just the protection of maybe some of these agencies that you say were had corruption problems, or what would there be about her case that would cause almost a panic in these agencies when you start making inquiries?
Well, I think from one standpoint, there was so much misconduct by everyone involved in Jones' case. I mean, the documents that we have recovered really show egregious misconduct on the part of, the district attorney's office, the Massachusetts State Police, and even the FBI. And they don't want that to be known. Now, did they, deceive the family, and therefore they don't want the family to know that, they've really botched things up and this isn't really what happened? When people have done things that they're not supposed to do, when they're wrong, they're going to cover it up. And they're going to strike out at someone who is definitely trying to come out and say, hey, this isn't right. If their case had merit, I would think that they would want to get as much out there as possible, because they are out there publicly supporting a book where there is so much documentation that refutes what he has said in both the Iannuzzi case and in Jones' case. It's mind-boggling.
So it's your impression, Eve, as we talk tonight, that you have, of course, the one unsolved homicide, which would be Jones, and you have a second incident of a wrongly convicted man being in prison for another homicide. Is that accurate to say?
That's accurate to say.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
No question about it in my mind.
Somebody mentioned in the chat room a little bit ago, they wanted to know, are you still married to Jones' brother? Was that there?
No, we are not married. We were divorced in 2004, so I had more than 25 years, of experiences with the family, and this is certainly a tragedy we shared together. And as I said, my daughters are Joan's nieces, and I had a special affection with Joan. I had a miscarriage the exact same night Joan disappeared, and through the ups and downs and the hurdles of this case, the emotional roller coaster that it was, I had four more. Joan will always be extremely special to me. It's unfortunate. I have tried to talk to the family and say, you really need to get involved with this and participate, because there are things coming out. And there were a lot of other victims, which Joan would never have wanted that. Joan would never have wanted her life so disrespected and so devalued to be used by authorities to frame another person for something they did not do.
And one last question, Eve, for me, and then I'll turn it back over to Kim. But I noticed in the chat room a while back that someone questioned about whether or not, because of the apparent animosity and the hostility you're experiencing from the authorities and trying to get this case brought to light or refocused, do you feel at all threatened? Do you feel in any way in danger or anything, because you have apparently some fresh information, possibly explosive stuff? Do you have any concerns for your personal well-being?
I do. I'll be very honest, I do. And I have had multiple, I work with an advocate here who has looked at various documents and things that I have in my particular set of circumstances. And anytime you've got information that people want concealed of this level and of this seriousness, yeah, I most definitely do. But I'll tell you that on the other side of the coin, I feel that I am safer by being vocal about it. You I'm not going to be intimidated and back down or succumb to any type of, you know, discrediting or devaluing or smearing or other things like that, because I have the documents. I can sit and I can read them for myself and go, this is not right, and what was going on here and why. You know, who is being protected?
Have you perhaps had any contact from some of the major news magazines in the 2020s or something interested in the story?
I have not at this point. Most of what I have done has been to pursue through different lawyers, trying to look at just the nature of this case and how do you go about it. My primary and first concern is to come forward as a witness in this case. We need to take a look at just what's being concealed in those files that they do not want people to see and do not want people to know. Because who knows who else that leaves vulnerable? As you said, do I feel threatened? Yeah, I've got an anonymous mail. That's pretty intimidating. That is the first and foremost. Am I seeking right now and looking to find avenues to make the public more aware of this case? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have been very bold as far as things that I've put up on the internet, but I've backed it up with documents, that there are some serious issues here. And there are some, as I said, there's someone had an agenda here, and a member of my family was intentionally murdered. That's mm-hmm. not okay. That's not okay.
Hey, and Eve, do you have, we gave out, someone posted the website in the chat room, but for people who are not in the chat room, can you give out any website information where there's more information about Joan's murder and some of the evidence and so forth?
Yes. If you Google in Joan Webster Murder dot YOLA, YOLASITE, YOLA site, .com. I am building a website there. There are documents that are up. There are a lot of photographs. There are news articles up there. I've put a very critical timeline. And one of the things that started to help things make sense is I've put everything in that timeline, everybody, everything, including family, to see what was going on, you know, who was doing what, who knew what when. And that's where the pieces started to all of a sudden make sense, and I could see where the real obstructions were and where there are, you know, maybe some areas to look at as far as motivation. You know, who wanted to murder Joan Webster? This was a sweet, wonderful human being, an incredible student, loved by people. You know, it's very difficult for anybody to conceive who would have wanted to hurt her. So, you know, I'm real curious. Who did she threaten?
Well, it sounds to me like you're not going to give up the hunt here very easily. So I got a feeling that this is going to be going forward in spite of the lack of cooperation that you've received so far.
Actually, the lack of cooperation has steeled my resolve that much more, because it's telling me that I'm right on the money. To be you know, and I have taken some personal attacks, most definitely. But I know myself. I know who I am as a person. And as I said, you know, these documents speak for themselves. And as far as what documents and things are up there, there is a lot up there to understand that things are not right in this case. That's number one. But the real explosive things are not up there yet. And part of that reason is because I am still trying to pursue to find the proper avenue. I don't want people sitting out there in the district attorney's office coming up with excuses and stories anymore to explain away information that I do have and that I've acquired. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give them that opportunity.
Okay, thanks a million, Eve. I'll turn it back over to Kim.
Thanks, Danny.
Okay. Well, we have about 20 minutes left. I just want to give out our phone number one more time here. It's 646-478-0982. Now, Eve, there's obviously a lot of players in this scenario. Let's get to that composite drawing now. When you saw it, did it look like someone you had recognized? Was it someone that you had possibly seen before, or someone that was a friend of hers from college? Was there any, did anything come to mind when you saw the composite?
The first thing that actually came to mind was the guy looks like an informant. There was not a particular identity that jumped out at me. But I do not have the complete report. I don't know how big this man was. I don't know how far away the individual was from him. I don't know what he saw them do. That's in files that have not been accessed at this time. I do want to see that. I'm not going to, you know, speculate and throw someone's name out there, but there is an individual involved in the case who has some general characteristics that match up with this. The man that was described had long hair, had a beard, full beard, and so did Trooper Andrew Palumbo. He was an undercover cop. There were times that he also fit that description.
Now, let's talk a minute about Trooper Andrew Palumbo. Now, he isn't even here to defend himself. He did pass away. He died in a motorcycle accident. What year was that, Joan?
1998,
right, July of 1998. Now, there's some interesting things about him. He did have a beard and he had long hair. Tell us about the gals who were at the Greyhound bus station. There were two women. He had followed two women at Logan Airport and gave them a ride. And mm-hmm. there was one other incident, too, he gave a woman a ride from Boston Greyhound bus station in 82, in January. Tell us a little bit about Trooper Palumbo.
Okay, Trooper Palumbo was an undercover cop. He worked in narcotics along with his superior, Sergeant Carmen Tamaro, and he worked with informants. He worked with informants. We do have documentation that there may have been some connection with these officers and what the FBI was doing, and that was trying to infiltrate and break down the mafia at that time in Boston. And I'm not going to the reason I bring that up is because the mafia was one faction of organized crime, but at the same time the FBI was trying to dismantle them, they were protecting members of another organized crime group, and that's James Bulger, Whitey Bulger, who's mm-hmm. infamous, and still on the FBI's most wanted list. So, you know, whatever efforts may have been noble on one cause were helping the other. And there were protected people in Whitey Bulger's group, including Bulger himself, who were murderers. They got it, and they were let off the hook. These guys were involved in quite a bit. And, you know, when I talk about organized crime and the corruption in Boston, you know, this was the bed of it right there. Mm-hmm. Trooper Palumbo, I have come to learn, you know, he was an experienced officer. He had worked for a long time. I actually met him face-to-face at one point in time, although he didn't look anything like, at that point in time, he was clean-shaven and his hair was cut. You know, different looks at different times. He did follow mm-hmm. some women. He did follow some women in Logan Airport and gave them a ride. They did not know who he was initially, and had turned around and confronted him. And that was at the same time, in the same time frame as he and Sergeant Tamara were working with the informant Robert Bond, trying to develop a statement. And the thing that's kind of significant about that is that one of those two individuals was someone who would have had personal knowledge, you know, in relationship to the Ian Newsy case and perhaps other matters. So that was, you know, that to me is something that really sticks in there as being something that's very significant. The incident mm-hmm. that took place in January of 1982, I don't know for certain whether it is Andy Palumbo. It was an undercover cop at the Greyhound bus station that gave a ride to a woman who had missed her bus, and he gave her a ride over to the other bus station. She said that he identified himself as an undercover cop, that everyone in both locations knew him. Certainly that would be a location where an undercover cop would work, just in the same fashion that they would at the airport. I mean, those were, you know, entry-exit areas for the city. You know, yeah, very unsettling. And that wasn't all mm-hmm. that long after Joan disappeared. So there are incidents
right.
that are showing these officers. But Trooper Palumbo also worked with all these different people that testified, people whose testimony was coerced, people whose testimony was changed, people who were threatened with prosecutions, or with two women were threatened with losing their children. And their testimony changed in the Iannuzzi grand jury to the Iannuzzi trial. Significant changes. And one of them was Marie Iannuzzi's sister. And she was actually assaulted. She went into hiding.
Oh, my goodness.
She went into hiding. Mr. Burke tries to say that Paradiso, who was sitting in jail, was the one intimidating her. And yet her testimony was beneficial to him. I mean, and plus at that point, he had been so vilified, I don't think he had a friend in the world almost. You know, the documents that have surfaced with that, there are some sworn affidavits, one of them even by a private investigator, you know, that it was the police and the prosecutor who were the threatening forces against these people and changing their testimony to gain a conviction in Iannuzzi.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of stuff. That's just, this case was just as dirty could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're about the only thing on a list of areas that indicate corruption in a case by authorities, about the only one I can't identify through records is whether they tampered with the jury or not. You know, but they were giving false information to the jury, certainly.
Eve, mm-hmm. can I interrupt with just a quick question?
Sure. Sure.
Actually, two. One thing I wanted to address is that one of the people from the chat room went to the website that you gave out.
Uh-huh.
Some areas are password protected. Is that what? How do they overcome that?
Okay.
Is that something that only you can get on?
Well, I have not opened those up yet, and let
okay.
me explain. And let me explain why. The reason I have it, for example, the contents of the suitcase. There's a question because Mr. Burke has identified and made claims in his book about certain items in the suitcase. Items need to be verified with records that are not yet accessible, what was in their evidence, because there's a particular item that I am interested in that did not show up in the suitcase. If she had it with her, then it was in the tote bag, and the tote bag was never recovered. So it's for the legal reasons that, you know, still pursuing some legal avenues that not everything's out there yet.
But it will be as
it will be. It will be.
It
will be.
The other question is, and I don't want you to answer with a name here.
Okay.
But I just want to know if, based on all the information that you have now, information that the rest of us don't have at this point, in addition to the questions about how the investigation was handled and about Paradiso and all this stuff, do you have, in your own mind, a suspect? Do you think you know a motive and suspect for Joan's murder?
As far as motive, I'm looking at some information right now that may very well lend itself to motive. And I'm very concerned about the stuff that I'm going through right now. But, you know, do I believe I have knowledge of who had specific knowledge about the case? I believe yes. I believe, and here's why. The informant statement that was used for both cases, Robert Bond's statement that was taken by Trooper Palumbo and Sergeant Tamaro, it was a false statement. There's plenty in there that's false. There's plenty in there that authorities had information already in their files to know that they were not producing a true statement. That's number one. But within that statement, they maintained a boat theory, which explained why there was no body, and they kept pushing it even as they gathered more and more information to exclude it. The second thing is they abandoned the MO that they were trying to attach to Paradiso for all these other murders and all these other things of strangulation. And strangulation, by the way, was actually a multiple choice option that Robert Bond gave these officers in his interview with them. So, I mean, he was kind of throwing out and leaving things open for the officers to kind of pull it together the way it suited them. They abandoned that, and they came up with the correct manner of death. Robert Bond pointed to the correct place on his head and described a lot of blood. And it, most assuredly, this injury would have created a lot of blood. The third thing is that Tim Burke and Palumbo, in their documents to the court and the way things were represented to the media, they actually twisted their informant's information. The informant's statement said that he hit Joan in the head to subdue her, then he raped her, and then he dumped her in the ocean. The way they came forward with it was that Paradiso raped her, then hit her in the head, and then dumped her in the ocean. You know, if you've got a case that's got merit, you don't have to be hiding all these things. You don't have to be lying. They were bringing for one of the things they asked. I am certain that the officers in that room, when they were interviewing Robert Bond, one or two of them knew what happened to Joan. I cannot imagine how they could be that accurate and be throwing this case off, because they were the ones responsible for this case, and this case was thrown off. I will say that they were, you know, they asked Robert Bond if anything had been tied to Joan to weight her down in the water, and that was asked multiple times in the interview. He said no, but then he'd go on and say, but he didn't say he didn't, you know, kind of leaving it open. Then all of a sudden, through Trooper Palumbo, who provided a photograph to the FBI for a bankruptcy case, which had nothing to do with Joan, supposedly, it was a smokescreen, they locate this woman, the FBI interviews her, and all of a sudden she comes out with a tabloid sensation, my lover boasted of being a mob hitman, chopped up bodies, tied cinder blocks to them, and dumped them in the ocean. Mr. Burke completely misrepresents her testimony. He lies in the book about when she is located, because he says she is the source that helped locate that boat in his book, and she was not located until a week after that boat was brought up. And she refused to testify at the trial. She refused. She was sick, absolutely sick. And she did testify in the pretrial. It was all over the papers. And she wanted to, you know, this woman was just, nothing backed up what she said. There were no cinder blocks found on the boat, no sawing tools, no body parts, no blood. There was no glass. There were no liquor bottles. You know, Mr. Burke is not telling the truth, and yet he is putting this book out there as true crime, and you've got a DA's office out there now claiming that they're using this book as a basis to solve other crimes. They're going to hurt other people, because I guarantee it hurts. It hurts to realize how a family member, you go through the pain of them being missing, you go through the pain of them being gone, and then to find out that everything you've been told about it isn't true. To disrespect Joan Webster in that way is inexcusable.
Oh, that's for sure. And that's what it is, too. And I don't know if you mentioned this earlier when you said her body, when you were talking about when her body was found, but she did have a hole in her skull.
She had a hole in her skull. She had a hole in her skull that had to have been inflicted with incredible leverage, you know, a full swing of, you know, a pipe or a bat, or it took out her entire right side of her head. And, you know, that doesn't happen in a crammed little boat with a whiskey bottle,
no.
A big whiskey bottle, a lumbering gallon or so whiskey bottle. And it doesn't happen when somebody can't get that kind of, he couldn't even raise his arms in that little boat cabin. And
right. And
Mr. Burke also claims, you know, that he's holding on to Joan at the same time with his other hand because he tries to explain splinters that Mr. Paradiso got in his finger that were treated about the time Joan disappeared. And he tried to claim that those were, he got those when he inflicted the fatal blow to Joan. I mean, the whole thing, when you really stop to go through it and start putting common sense and start putting the real facts in there, it's like, it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. I was going to say, now Bond was a jailhouse snitch, supposedly. He's in the Who's Cow with Paradiso, and Paradiso is telling him the story. It almost sounds odd that Paradiso would give such in-depth information.
He didn't.
And the more they, you know, I held her with one hand, and it doesn't even sound like something that that a couple of cons would say in, you know, in jail, in cells next to each other or something. It just doesn't sound plausible. What do you think, Denny? That just doesn't sound right.
A lot of things don't sound right here, and that's one of them. Yes, I agree.
Go ahead.
When I went through the documents, I was actually able to see everywhere where authorities were able to pull out information. For example, part of the statement that Bond made claimed that Lenny said he slipped on the rocks. Well, it was kind of rainy the night that Marie Iannuzzi was murdered, and he dumped her out on a bank of rocks by the Pine River. That's where she was dumped, not that Paradiso dumped her there, but that's where she was dumped. And one of the first officers on the scene when her body was found the next day, he slipped on the rocks, and he testified to that. And all of a sudden, it ends up in, you know, Mr. Bond's statement. It's, you know, I can see where everything came from.
Yeah. Well, in another thing in my notes here when we're talking about Bond, in January of 83, Tim Burke, Palumbo, and Tamaro meet with Bond and offer him a manslaughter charge. Bond granted a retrial. Now, the reason why Bond was in jail when Paradiso came in was because he was in jail on a murder charge, correct?
That's correct. It was his second murder charge. Second murder charge. He had gotten out on parole, and within months, he had actually murdered the woman who was a prison advocate who had helped him get a parole. And he blew her brains out. And I've got a couple of news articles that, you know, describe that and his sentencing and whatnot. His trial started on December 9th, He and Paradisa were both moved into the Charles Street Jail on December the 8th. They had no opportunity for any interaction that day, as he claimed, because there was a lockdown on that day. Mr. Bond's cell was moved from the third tier and moved down in proximity to Paradiso's cell. The whole thing was kind of set up so that, questions could be posed. And I could even, imagine Paradiso, throwing back, I dumped her in the ocean. Saying something that would be normally be so ludicrous, because it is ludicrous. This was November 28th, 1981. The weather was bad and, extremely windy that night. You couldn't get on a little boat and go bobbing around. You couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very, I hate to say it, but we are out of time. This is a fascinating case, and it needs the transparency, and it needs someone to take a look at it. And I can't wish you enough good luck in your quest to get this out there. I can't thank you enough, too, for being on the show with us tonight, Eve. It's just been such a pleasure. And I hope you'll come back and do this again sometime. We can do another follow-up.
I would very much like to. I mean, there's a lot here. It's a lot for people to absorb, I know. And that's why the website's there. I hope people will take time to look at it and go back and look at it, because I'm updating things. I add things. I'm trying to help it be a coherent thing to follow, because it is difficult, and I understand that. I've lived it. So, therefore, it's easier for me to go in and grasp, but even I get stymied at times going, oh, my God. I can't thank both of you enough for giving me an opportunity, to talk about Joan's case. It deserves to be heard. She deserves the truth.
Right. She does. And Denny, would you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I agree. It's a case that certainly needs to be pursued, and I hope we can get with Eve again in the future and keep at it.
I would be more than happy to. This is a case very worthwhile. It was a young woman that was very worthwhile.
And thank you very much, Eve. It's really been, a horrible subject, but very nice talking with you, and you're very well organized, and I applaud you for your efforts and not giving up in this case.
I thank you so much. Good night.
And thank you. Thank you, Eve, and good night. And thank you, Denny, as always. And if anybody would like to have their case looked at on our show, just give me send me an email at kim@crimeandmystery.com. That is my email. And Denny, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim. Good night.
Good night now.
You still there, Kim?
Yeah. We're streaming live, though.
Oh, okay.
I'll give you a call.